Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I explore the possibilities of who we are as human beings and the unfolding of consciousness and where we're going as a planetary race that is waking up to our higher potential. So tonight, we're investigating the ancient science, the original science, in a way, of alchemy and its transformational powers on all levels of consciousness. I was just playing a song called Green Fire from a band called In the Fire, which is really about the technology of alchemy is the fire, and it's been used as a metaphor for everything since the beginning of time. So tonight we'll be talking about that with Aurelius Electra, true alchemist. Welcome to the program, Aurelius.
Hi, thank you, Alan. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
So you talk about alchemy on all levels. There's the physical alchemy, and then there's the spiritual alchemy, where the body is turned into spirit, as well as the lead being turned into gold. So is that the way you play with this kind of
exactly. Alchemy is exactly that. It's the art of transformation or transmutation, and that's basically the whole premise behind it. Is the alchemists were traditionally philosophers of nature, and they would study nature and understand how nature worked and how evolution worked on a macro scale as well as a micro scale, and they work to emulate those same principles within themselves and within the environment around them. So essentially, they were evolving the environment around them as well as evolving themselves at the same time.
Oh, I also want to tell people that Aurelius Electra will be in New York this weekend at Roger Green's Feng Shui School of Nutrition, Feng Shui Consulting. I don't know what's the name of that school exactly, but anyway, Roger Green's a good friend of mine, and he's conducting a course with Aurelius. And the number you can call is 212-421-2768 to find out more. Or the website again for that course is it Feng Shui Seminars?
Yeah, fengshuiseminars.com.
Right. So now I hear two different stories about alchemy. First, that the turning of lead into the gold or the base metal into gold was really a metaphor for turning the body into light, into spirit. And other alchemists I've talked to say, no, it really is about turning lead into gold. It's really about the gold. And there's these techniques we can do that will turn lead into gold, although I've never seen, you know, lead into gold. So you're saying it's both, or?
Yes, I would go with both. That first stream you mentioned, where it's just metaphor, sort of came from Carl Jung, and he was an analytical sort of psychologist and student of contemporary with Freud, and he had, you know, interviewed a lot of his patients and doing psychoanalysis, and he realized that a lot of the stories that they were telling about the dreams they were having had these alchemical imagery in them, and so he read a lot of the alchemical texts and said, well, you know, they're not really talking about something physical here. What they're talking about is internal. But in actual reality, it's sort of there's a hermetic axiom: as it is above, so it is below, and those principles apply universally. So I tend to look at it as both a physical, practical side of alchemy, where you can make quite a few different medicines from various different metals, and ultimately the transmutation of the metals is your ultimate goal. But those, as you are working in the laboratory and performing these works, there's a reflection that goes on internally, and you are evolving at the same time as you are working with your basic elements on a mixing in a chemistry type setting as well.
So the real alchemists were truly able to transform themselves with the process of making gold.
Yes, and exactly. And a lot of the ideas about gold, you'll hear stories about potable gold. There are various different medicines that you can make with the metals, even starting with lead and silver and tin. They can all be made into various powerful medicines, and this was all part of the mineral work in alchemy.
Go back. The greater work and the lesser work, because there's the work with plants, and then there's the work with minerals, right? The plants are the lesser work, and the minerals are the greater work. Is that true?
Yes, that's essentially how it works. I guess what we should do is put it into reference is go back to the three kingdoms. There's essentially the plant kingdom, which is the working with the plants, and it's basically an advanced form of what we'd know as herbology today, and that's what we're doing this weekend with the workshop. It's sort of a introduction to alchemy, and we're making spagyric medicines from rosemary. And so there's the three kingdoms are the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the mineral kingdom. And basically the principles in the lesser works are to start in the plant kingdom, because it's you get your sea legs basically with the plant kingdom, and you make various herbal tonics and medicines. And what it is a sort of a reflection of the work you'll do in the mineral kingdom down the road.
It's interesting though that they call the plant kingdom the lesser work when plants seem to be more evolved than minerals. I mean,
right.
It's just...
Alchemists always held that consciousness is sort of universal. And today we look at, animals and plants as sort of having a consciousness and an intelligence and a life force. But what the alchemists of old believed was that consciousness was contained in all matter and everything was living. So essentially the minerals that are in the ground are actually living. They're born from seeds. They grow. It's just they have such a long lifespan and change and grow over such long periods of time, whereas plants and animals only live a short period of time. So we don't have enough a perspective to see this sliver of a life of a crystal, let's say, that you have on that you'll buy from a crystal shop or find in the ground. Well, that crystal's been living and growing for millions of years. And so the alchemists believed that there was a life force in there and an actual consciousness to that thing. So they would work with those minerals in that sense. So that's kind of how that comes about.
So with the real alchemists, I mean, the ones who really in touch, were they able to access the consciousness of the mineral itself and sort of coax it into transformation?
Yeah, exactly, and this can work. It, like I said, the plant kingdom kind of mirrors the work in the mineral kingdom, and the alchemists sort of divided this up into what they called the three principles or the three essentials. And this comes from Paracelsus, and he came up with these terms: the sulfur, the salt, and the mercury. And the salt is essentially the matrix or the body of the being. So in the plant kingdom, the salt is what makes up the structure of the plant, and then the sulfur is considered the soul of the plant, and the mercury is the spirit of the plant. So it's essentially the body, the soul, the spirit is the salt, the sulfur, and the mercury.
But wait, what's the difference between soul and spirit? A lot of people use those words interchangeably. How does an alchemist differentiate between soul and spirit?
Right, okay. And the way that you differentiate between that and alchemy is the spirit is considered universal. The spirit is considered the life force that's shared between all the different plants, let's say, or all the different people. So we have our life force is considered our spirit. The soul is sort of individual to that plant or that person. So in the plant kingdom, the salts, as I was saying, is actually the salts of the plant. And the way you get that is you burn the actual plant into ashes, and those ashes are refined, and you're extracting the salts of that plant through the white ash that you would obtain by burning the plant down. And the soul, or the sulfur, is actually the essential oils. And then the mercury of the plant is what we sometimes call mercury or spirits, and that's how we got that name. It's actually alcohol. So the alcohol can be derived from all plants, but when you distill the essential oils from each plant, they all have their unique signature. So that's why the alchemist considered the sulfur or the soul to be the individual sort of essence of that plant. Well, the mercury was the life force.
Well, let me put that together. So you have the body of the plant, you burn that. That is the salt. That is the earth of the plant. And then you extract the essential oils or the chemical composition in a sense, and you, or the essential matter, and that's the essential oil, and that is the soul. And right. Then the spirit is the alcohol you make from. From where do you make the alcohol from?
From fermenting the herb. See, the spirit's considered sort of universal because what it's actually doing is the spirit of the plant is entering through the matrix, let's say, of the alcohol when you ferment the plant. So that's your first step in the stage of extracting or creating one of these spagyric medicines. Is you would actually your first step would be to take the fresh herb right from the garden. And you would put it in a water still, and you would pass steam through the fresh herb, and that steam rises and takes off the soul or the sulfur, and that's the essential oils that we know today in aromatherapy, quite popular in alternative medicine today and well known. But the alchemists were the first to do the extractions of these. And then you would essentially take that plant matter that you had finished extracting the essential oils from, and you would put it into a fermenter just like you would make beer or wine. And you would add water and a little bit of yeast, and that would ferment into your alcohol, which would be about, 10-20% alcohol. And then the alchemist would distill that again to refine it. So the whole idea of extracting these principles is to... You're taking the plant apart, and you're refining each piece of it as fine as you can get it, and then you're recombining. And that's coagula.
Then the spirit, the soul, and the body, and you recombine them. You take the ash, the oil, and the alcohol, and you mix them back together.
That's right. And when you've mixed them back together in the after they've all been refined, that's what we call a spagyric tincture or a spagyric essence, depending on how far you process the plant and how far a stage you go.
And then why is that so powerful to mix those distilled elements back together?
Well, as we were talking earlier, how the philosophers had studied nature and would assist in the evolution of matter, it's considered a way of when that plant... a way of refining that plant into its finest essences in both in all three of the principles, basically the sulfur, salt, and mercury. And by doing the distillations over and over again, each time you do it, that alcohol gets to a higher and higher content of alcohol, less of the phlegm, as we call it, or the caput mortuum, the dead head, gets removed. So what you have in the end are three very fine and powerful essences that all came from that single plant, and when they're recombined, it just makes that medicine much more powerful. The way I say it is, basically, you can take a herb and you can make a pot of tea, and that cup of tea that you drink is sort of like eating 50 capsules of the raw herb, or you can go to the next level and you can make a tincture of that herb. And that tincture, just a couple drops, is sort of like eating a whole pound of the raw herb. But when you make a spagyric tincture, just a couple drops of that spagyric tincture is like eating, you'll get the same medicinal effect without the side effects as eating like 10 pounds of the raw herb.
So what,
so
can we buy
of
these
concentrating?
Can we buy the? We can't usually buy these spagyric tinctures.
No, they're not very common, and the reason being is you put a lot of work into making them, and the science behind that has been somewhat lost in obscurity. There are a few people around that make them, but essentially it's always been held that the most powerful medicines are made by yourself. So because there's a lot of work involved and the knowledge has been generally, diluted in modern-day pharmaceuticals, and, you know, even herbology doesn't have too good a name in the modern pharmaceutical sense, but all these things were born from the alchemists and sort of got lost in the past through time.
But is there some kind of metaphysical principle? I mean, you have the spirit, you have alcohol, so I'm sure alcohol came from the making of the alchemical formulas, but they forgot the rest of it when people started just indulge in alcohol, and in
exactly.
a way, it destroys a person's spirit. I mean, there's this
exactly.
metaphysical. Not battle, but confrontation that happens when you abuse the spirit of a plant, right? So can you
yes,
talk?
And smoking yeah. is the same way. You can look at, you know, how smoking's been commercialized and addictive and dangerous for your health, but those are originally herbs that were used for medicines by the native people, and they only used them in ceremonial sense. They used them with intention. But it seems in the West, as soon as we get a hold of something like that over the years, we've perverted it and, you know, turned it into something mass marketable and sold it back to the people. And that's when it's done. It's destruction. It's not held sacredly anymore. The alchemists were actually, they found stills in the Indus Valley in India that are 5,000 years old. But if you look at any modern scientific textbook, they'll tell you that we only discovered how to distill alcohol in the 1500s. Before that, all there was wine and beer. So why are these? Why are they finding these ancient stills 5,000 years BC in India? Well, the fact is that people, the ancients, knew how to do these processes, but they kept it sacred and they kept it to themselves. They didn't disseminate it to the public. And even in the early, early 10th to 15th century, there were alchemists throughout Arabia and Egypt and that, and they kept these things to themselves. They kept the knowledge of making finer spirits and alcohol to themselves because they knew if it got released to the public, it would cause trouble.
What kind of trouble would it cause?
Well, just essentially what we have today. I mean, when all that stuff came about, you know, we had passed, it was in the middle of the Dark Ages, and the world sort of took a turn at that point when a lot of that alchemical knowledge sort of, it came from Egypt originally and then went into Arabia. But then a lot of the people, after they were sort of forced out of Egypt, they kind of went to Arabia. And that would have been at the time, you know, after Rome had taken control, after Alexander the Great, and they did a lot of things like burning the Library of Alexandria, and it was really over gold. You know, you're talking, where's the proof of this gold? How could the alchemists have been physically making gold? Well, that's what they were afraid of at the time. They thought they would, because there was a lot of information out in those books, on how to transmutate different metals into higher metals, they thought it was going to undermine their economy because they were gold-based economies back then. And all the noble people throughout Europe, they actually passed laws to make it illegal to make gold. And the Roman emperors, you know, sent out orders to have all these books destroyed that contained any information on how to convert any of the metals into gold.
Oh, because I thought it was the Christians that burned the Library at Alexandria.
Yeah, from Rome. They kind of, got labeled with that, but it was definitely the Roman emperors who, I guess it was like within years after they officially declared Christianity as being the main religion of Rome, and they gave up the old gods. That's when they set out to destroy a lot of the pagan texts and a lot of the alchemical texts.
But getting back to the lesser work that we just described, if someone was to do those processes and refine that, where is the spiritual development in just doing the kind of laboratory work? I mean, how do they pull that evolution into the process?
Right. Well, it kind of has to be taken on yourself. There's an old alchemical axiom that is ora et labora, which is kind of where we get our word laboratory today. It means to literally pray and work. And the alchemists would essentially have a library, an oratorium where they would do their spiritual practice and their laboratory that they would work together in one location. And what happens when you are working with the plants and you're that intimately involved in understanding how nature works by actually planting the plant in yourself in the ground, watching it grow from seed and go through all its stages and harvest, you're reflecting on that life, and when you harvest that plant and process it into the medicine, then you reflect on internal separation. So essentially, when you understand that you're dealing with the body, the soul, and the spirit of the plant, well, you can't help but reflect on yourself and say, okay, well, what am I doing to my body? What is my spirit gaining from this? What is my soul? And by doing that reflection, that's how you come about those spiritual changes.
Oh, I see. So it has to do with what they talk about, mirror neurons, that everything we see out there, we're feeling in here. So if we're identifying with the plant that we grew out of the ground, it is in a way us, this
exactly.
plant.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The alchemists, the first law of the hermetics is all is one. And the alchemists essentially believe that everything in the universe is all one. These are all sort of fractal, recursive paradigms that we live in, where everything is just a sort of a mere reflection itself. In Hinduism, they called it Indra's net. And Indra's net is essentially like a large net spread out through, it's a matrix. And at every node in the net is a sphere, and each sphere reflects all the other spheres. And essentially what they're talking about there is this world we live in, everything is fractal and everything is recursive, and these mirror neurons, like you were mentioning, this is exactly how the meditation works to understand. Mm. Yeah.
So this weekend you're going to take rosemary, you said, and work with that plant?
Yeah, well, essentially what we're doing, because there's a lot of work, like I was saying, we kind of condensed it down into the weekend workshop, but I've been working for the last two or three weeks on all the processes back home, because obviously we don't have enough time to do that, but we are going to take the three principles that I've worked on and refined over the last few weeks, and now we're going to actually do the coagula part where we're going to put them back together.
I mean, so how do you mix alcohol and oil? And I mean,
right.
Easy. Yeah, how would you do that?
Okay, so I started out with rosemary, and I bought about 10 pounds of fresh rosemary. And where I live, rosemary doesn't grow too well. It does grow in the summer, but we get a lot of snow in the winter, so it doesn't grow all year round. So I had to buy it from a supplier, but I got fresh organic rosemary, 10 pounds of it. And I put it in a steam distillation process where essentially there's a pot of hot steam that it injects through the herb, and it goes through a condenser. The steam rises up and it condenses and falls down. And even in to give you a perspective, when you're sitting there watching this in this sort of alchemical apparatus, it's all clear and you can see that it mirrors the earth. So as water rises and heats and goes into vapor from the oceans, forms into clouds and rains down, that's exactly what happens in the flask. Inside of your flasks and your apparatuses, they're actually mirror reflections of what's happening in the atmosphere around the Earth. So you have sort of a microcosm in your laboratory of the entire planet.
That's a really great way of looking at it. Yeah, right.
So that's just the first step. So then your essential oil is distilled off, and it sort of floats on top of the water. So what I do is I separate that out, and then that goes into a smaller distiller that refines that oil, usually distill it seven times. The alchemists, of course, wrote in these sort of allegories and in codes. So what they called that was the flying of seven eagles. And so what that means is that they would distill that oil over seven times. And so it was symbolized by an eagle essentially rising up and landing again in your receiver.
I see. So then it's how much oil do you get out of 10 pounds of rosemary?
Yeah, you'd be surprised how little oil you get. Rosemary is fairly, each plant has different quantities of essential oils, and some plants have no essential oils in them at all. And I think out of that 10 pounds, I probably got about maybe 10 milliliters of oil, like essentially a very small vial of oil.
Wow.
And yeah, I know. So if you look at some oils that are very expensive, like rose oil, for instance, it takes an entire, it would take an entire truckload or a living room full of rose petals to essentially to distill one bottle of rose oil.
Wow, so that's why rose oil is so expensive.
That's why, yes.
I see. So, okay, so you've distilled, and you now have the essential oil of rosemary, and then...
So that's my sulfur, okay.
Why don't they just call it this soul or the, you know, why do they have to call it the sulfur?
Well, those terms were kind of made, it was Paracelsus that came up with that, but they looked at it as it is like the element sulfur. They were never talking, because in a lot of their books, you know, people might read them that didn't have any alchemical knowledge, and in a way it was to protect their knowledge, because people would just take regular sulfur and try to process it, as they're mentioning in the text. Of course, it wouldn't work. And but they used it as allegory because it has similar properties. Like essential oil is often a yellowish color, sort of like sulfur. It's very volatile, like sulfur, so it'll light on fire. It leaves no trace behind. If you put it on a piece of fabric on your shirt or something like that, that good essential oil that isn't contaminated will evaporate completely and leave no trace behind. So they use it as having sort of similar properties to the sulfur.
I see. Okay, so that's one step. You have the essential oil now. Then what's the next process?
Right. So the next process, I took all the leftover herb that was in the oil still, and I put it into a primary fermenter. And this would be just a large bucket, similar that you would have in your own beer-making kit, if anybody's ever made beer at home. I put the body of the herb in there, and I filled it up with water, and I just put a little bit of yeast on there, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And then I put the lid on it. The real purists, alchemists, they'll just leave the lid off for a day or two, because these yeasts are naturally floating in the air. So you don't actually need the yeast, and you put your lid on, and you put a little airlock on it, and over time the plant will naturally ferment. And that will produce sort of a wine, a rosemary wine. And actually I've made a few herbal wines that are very tasty at that point. And then I've taken that the herbal wine, essentially the rosemary wine, and put that in the distiller, and then distill that again seven times. So then we get our mercury.
What do you distill the wine for, the rosemary wine? What are you looking for?
The mercury. That's the mercury element that we're extracting at that point. So that's the spirit of the wine. That's why we call alcohol spirits.
Oh, wait, but it's already fermented as an alcohol, right?
Right, yes. Well, the fermentation process is the result. The alcohol is the result of the fermentation process.
Right, but then you distill it to refine the alcohol?
The alcohol, exactly.
Because, wait, when you burn it, what happens? You get more, the water gets out, you're left with more finer alcohol. Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. Because alcohol boils at a lower boiling rate than water. Water boils at 100. Alcohol boils at 78 degrees Celsius. So what we do is just adjust the heat so it's enough temperature for the alcohol to evaporate, but not the water. And, of course, the alcohol holds on to a little bit of water. So each time that you do the distillation, your percentage of alcohol climbs higher and higher and higher.
Oh, I see. That clears it up. I didn't realize that. And
yes.
So you keep distilling pure and pure alcohol.
Right.
Until the seventh
alcohol time. Is very hydrophilic, which means it loves water. So it holds on to that water. It's hard to get it to separate from that water.
So now you've had seven times distillation the oil and seven times distillation the alcohol. And then what do you do?
Okay. Now we take our bulk herb out of that fermenter. And we bring that out, and you basically put that in a metal pan, or what we call calcination, and then we light it on fire. We'll add a little bit of the pure alcohol onto the dried herb, and then you just basically light it with a match, and it'll incinerate the herb. And now that'll burn down to a gray ash within a few hours, but that gray ash will...
Why does it take so long to burn a plant?
Well, and that's just the beginning. That's essentially getting the driving off in a chemical sense. What you're doing is you're driving off the chemical, basically the carbon, and that's what makes things black. You're driving away the carbon.
Okay.
And so the alchemists had three stages of these things. They called the negredo stage, which means the black stage, and the albedo stage, which is the white stage. And the third stage is a rubedo, which is a red. So once your plant burns down into this ash, of course, it's very gray, right?
Yeah.
But if you continue to burn, and then at that point, you know, you produce a lot of smoke. So that work has to be done outside. And as long as you don't have neighbors that can complain, you can burn the stuff off. But eventually it stops smoking, and that's when you can bring it back into the laboratory. But you continue to burn, and you continue
but
to burn.
You burn the ash? You keep burning the ash?
Yes.
Oh, and the ash will burn again, you're saying?
And it will continue to burn, yes. So what happens is driving off the blackness. You're going from the negredo stage into the albedo stage, and that ash will get whiter and whiter and whiter the longer you heat it.
And then what? And that's the white stage, the albedo stage.
Yeah, that's the white stage, and that's we stop there for the spagyrics. You can take this farther, and you can create a stone from the plant. It's called a plant stone, and the plants can be made into a hard stone. But then you know all these processes in alchemy. It's like the more you learn, the more you realize you can go a little bit farther and a little bit farther.
You take the ash though. And then you take the alcohol that you've made, and then you take the oil, and then you just mix them together in a glass or something?
Yeah, that's right. You would just use a beaker, and it's a very interesting reaction to watch, because what happens is, you know, as we've seen earlier, the essential oil, it sits on top of the water. It doesn't mix with the water. And
but there is
same,
water.
Same with the alcohol. It you know, it likes the water and it doesn't like to be separated. But these three work synergistically together to unify and to bind back into one essence.
Oh, so they just merge together, the soul and spirit and the body, huh?
Yeah. And it's a very magical process to watch right in the beaker before your eyes. It kind of fizzes and sizzles and you can see the movement around. It recreates, reanimates the herb is what we would say.
Do you have to take the same plant that you've used and use them, or could I take a different rosemary plant and use the alcohol for that? It doesn't have to be the actual plant itself.
Right. Well, yeah, for the mercury, you definitely can. In fact, the mercury is considered universal. You could use any plant to do. Like the real purists will do what I did and basically make it all from that one plant. But the mercury is essentially universal, and you could even have distilled alcohol from another plant. You could even, there's shortcuts in the work, and one of them is that you don't necessarily have to ferment your own plants. You can pick your plants from the garden, and you can go to the liquor store and buy a bottle of vodka and use that as your tincturing alcohol.
But in your case, so you have these three, the sulfur, the mercury, and the... what was the other thing? Sulfur, mercury, and the salt.
The salt, yes.
In one beaker, you have these three that you combine, and then how do you make that into a tincture? How is that? What do you do then?
So essentially, once they're all recombined, you put that in a bottle, and you will let that sit because it has to digest. And that just means that you give it a certain period of time for those three principles to really unify and come back into one essence again.
So, and how long would that be for rosemary?
And it's not very long. It's about a couple of weeks. I let them sit at that point. And then I would take it out and just run it through filters again. And
what?
That can be, that can be quite simple. You don't have to be all complicated and have chemical, fancy chemistry equipment for that. A lot of this stuff can be done, what I do in the class is show you how to basically build a lot of your own systems from common things in your kitchen.
Okay, and then you have this thing that's been settled for a few weeks, and then what do you do with it?
Yeah, so now you filter it just to get any of the ashes and from the salts that didn't combine with it. Most of them have, and they're fully integrated, and that'll pass through a filter, no problem. But there's a little bit of residue that's left from a bit of the herb and a little bit of the salts that are left behind. And basically you filter that and you put that in a bottle, and that's your medicine. And that will last for years as well. It remains effective for quite a long time.
Well, do you take just a drop of that, or you take that and you add that to something else to make a tincture? How do you use that?
Yeah, the best way to use it is you can take a few drops. Something like rosemary is fairly pleasant tasting, so you can take it straight on your tongue, or you can put a few drops in a glass of water or a glass of wine is traditionally how it was taken.
And then what will that do? What will they? What's the healing benefits of rosemary?
Well, the healing benefits of rosemary is very good for the digestive system. So it's good for the stomach, and it also has a lot of properties that are very good for the memory and the mind. So I like to use it for study. A lot of the students I teach in my class are taking herbology or various different courses. So I recommend that they use it while they're studying, and what you can do is just take a few drops while you're reading something. And when it comes time to, when you want to call up that information again, when you go into an exam, you take a couple drops on your tongue, and magically you can fully recall everything that you had, because you have a sort of an association with that sense of the rosemary going in you, as well as the phytochemical content of those plants have been proven to be, medicinally effective for a lot of the neural transmissions and things that are taking place in the brain.
So that's one level that you've just described, what they call the minor work, right?
Right.
The lesser work.
That would be the lesser works, or the opus minor. Yeah.
Right. So then, and this, it was a science back then. There were lots of, in the Middle Ages, at least around Paracelsus's time and before. Now, they took those same ideas and then applied it to minerals, but they couldn't, because the mineral doesn't have oil or alcohol. So, yeah, talk about how the lesser work then became the greater work.
Okay, so essentially all those processes that you've learned in the lesser works have similar elements when you start in the mineral works. Now it gets a lot more complicated, and what we actually do is we take a piece of the part of the plant kingdom, and we bring it into the mineral kingdom to process it. And there's various different paths that you can use, but essentially in the mineral kingdom, your menstruum is what we call what dissolves the actual metals would be acids. And those acids, of course, could be made from plants. One of the most common paths is called the acetate path, and that's using acetic acid. And acetic acid comes from vinegar. Everybody knows it, and you know that smell that when you smell that vinegary smell, right. That's acetic acid. And in vinegar, it's only like 2 to 5%, but that can be refined into a much higher quality percentage. And that will actually dissolve the metals.
Mm.
And it gets quite complicated in the mineral work, and there's a lot of different paths. And the other thing about working with the plants that I should cover here is that in order to prepare yourself for the mineral work, what you really want to do is be experienced enough and have your body. Because when you're taking these spagyrics, they actually do physical cleansing on your body, as well as the different mental openings in a sort of a spiritual sense. And what you would traditionally do is do 7 different herbs, which corresponded to the 7 planets. Mm-hmm. So the 7 planets of old were Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus, the Moon, and the Sun. And Mars,
right.
So each of the plants, of course, sort of correspond to those that you'd make.
But with plants that correspond, which correspond to the 7 days of the week, of course. But
yeah, absolutely. Monday is Moon Day. Sunday is the Sun. And,
so what are the plants that correspond to the metals, the days, the planets?
Right. So. The book I use in the class is called Culpepper's Herbal, and it's sort of an older herbal. If you read a lot of the older herbals, they give the characteristics, like astrological characteristics to the plant. So they'll actually categorize a plant. For instance, something that's got some fire to it, that's hot, like cayenne, let's say cayenne pepper, they would associate with Mars, because Mars is the fiery planet, also associated in the mineral kingdom with iron, right?
Well, what are the 7 classical plants that are normally used as spagyrics according to the 7 planets?
Well, that's kind of open to you. I mean, for each of the planets, I mean, I give people a list probably of about 20 to 30 herbs for each planet. And then I leave that up to them, something that they feel an affinity with that they want to work with. But generally, a lot of the solar herbs are things like sunflower, St. John's wort. You know, you even hear you see the sun when you look at them. They're composites. They reflect the light from the sun. And so you basically go through each of the 7 planets, pick one of the herbs that resonates with you for that.
The moon plants would be what then?
The lunar plants are, let's see, what am I working with right now? One is chickweed. That's fairly common. It grows in everybody's garden. You know, a lot of people ask. But the lunar aspects of the plant sort of have the mental faculties to them. So a lot of the, even some of the psychoactive plants, like the poppies and that, would relate to the moon.
But the power, the real power, is in the mineral kingdom, because that is the, in a way, the densest and in the way I...
And the oldest, the most ancient,
and,
right?
And the closest to creation itself is that, density...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All the work in the mineral kingdom, like, you can't just jump into the mineral kingdom. Traditionally, what happened to people when they start making or taking one of these medicines, even if it was properly prepared, is they would consume it, and a lot of people and a lot of alchemists throughout the time literally went insane. There's a very fine line when you're working with the metals, because a lot of them are, you know, extremely poisonous, or you have very poisonous stages along the way. And what happens when you make the medicines out of them, they become very psychoactive, and unless you're prepared, if you prepared yourself through the groundwork of the plant kingdom, or before you started into the mineral kingdom, you can't just jump right in.
I've heard, I mean, speaking of minerals, I've heard of things like oil of gold. How do you get oil from a metal? I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but how would you get,
Well, that's quite a complicated process, and it's still kind of obscure for a reason, because a lot of people, what I say to people, do the plant work before we get to the mineral work. It's kind of like jumping the gun, and it would really be beyond the scope of what we're talking about here to get into that for sure.
But it is possible to get oil from minerals, and but then if you want to share, you can. Have you made gold? Have you made
A lot of people ask that. I usually generally tell people, what the background is behind all that and how that story works. And this is a good segue into the Ormus. That's another thing that we're going to be working with.
Yeah,
here.
I wanted to talk to you about Ormus, but tell me about
Okay, so sure. So, this whole idea sort of comes from the Philosopher's Stone. Then the Philosopher's Stone is considered the opus major, the great work in alchemy. It's the ultimate end goal for the alchemist. And the Philosopher's Stone traditionally had two principles. And the first one is the one that everybody's heard of. It can transmute lesser metals into higher metal or create gold from lead. Now, the less known principle and the necessity of this Philosopher's Stone is it's also a medicine. You can take it internally, and it will completely cleanse your body of all disease. So I think what's become pretty popular these days, and if you go online and search for Ormus, O-R-M-U-S, you'll find that a lot of people are using sea salt or salt water to create these what's been termed monoatomic elements from various different metals. And the principles are that a lot of the metals that have been in the rivers and the streams, you have gold and iridium, rhodium, platinum, all the platinum metal groups are well dispersed in the ocean. And it's well known scientifically that there's a certain quantity of all the different metals in the ocean. And the Ormus process is essentially what's called the wet method, is a precipitation of the salts that are in the ocean water. Now, you don't just want to go out and grab ocean water, like let's say around New York here, but if you could take a boat out and get some fresh water that is quite clean, you can actually use that. Or what we do in class is we reconstitute our own ocean water from sea salt.
Right.
We basically take a raw, coarse sea salt and dissolve it into the water, and then we go through an alchemical process to condense that sea salt into sort of a mineral extract, and it forms this sort of crystalline matrix grid in which there are these platinum metal groups in very small molecular atomic states within the matrix of this, and this can actually be consumed, and it's a good way to get not only a lot of essential minerals that you're not getting in today's modern diet, because a lot of these minerals have washed away from the farmers' fields. You always hear stories about the food contains a small percentage of the minerals that it used to contain 100 years ago, because we've over-farmed the land. And as we've done that, a lot of those minerals have been washed into the ocean. Well, this is a good way to get them back.
Okay, so you're going to make Ormus at Roger's place over the weekend. Everyone's welcome to come now. Now, you do that with – I made Ormus or the white powder from Dead Sea water and lye. And you bring it up to a certain pH until it precipitates. Is that the process?
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly how we did.
But that's not Is that still alchemical, what you're doing there?
Yeah, it is alchemical. A lot of people say that, you know, Ormus is not alchemy because, you know, they're not using the fire. But if you understand the subtleties of it, you know, one of my favorite definitions of alchemy is the art of transmutation through fire. And so there's always, you know, something's got to involve fire. But the alchemists had something they called the secret fire. And if you realize that essentially when you create the lye, you're using sodium, it's a sodium hydroxide is the chemical name. And when you put that in the water, it heats up. And that's where your secret fire is coming from. The alchemist sort of spoke in allegories and terms, but you know, you don't have to physically see a flame. There's four or five different types of fire in alchemy, and that generating heat like that is one of them. And then the other thing is that you're using the chemistry of nature. You're essentially emulating what nature would do, because in certain places where the soil is very fertile and very lush, well, oftentimes there's been a volcano or something in the area. So the idea, the principle is that these minerals, these elements sort of get recycled, and that volcanic ash, which is often highly paramagnetic, which also makes plants grow very well, is very rich in these ormus elements, very rich in these metals when you analyze the soils. And so that's sort of getting washed from the land, taken into the sea, and if you look at ancient seabeds, you know, settling down, and the minerals going back into the land and then getting cast out through volcanic activity again, it's sort of nature's natural cycle to restore.
Well, I think it's very important to tell people the kind of a mystical or mystery behind these ormus chemicals, you know, the erodium and iridium that,
right.
that Hudson discovered, I guess, or maybe
sure.
before.
Sure. Well, you know, the story goes back to, as you mentioned there, David Hudson. He's sort of the one who actually popularized a lot of this. Barry Carter's done a lot of work in the recent years, but originally David Hudson was he was sort of an Arizona dirt farmer, and he had a cotton farm, and you know, the soil in Arizona is that red, rocky soil. It's not very productive. And so he would use an acid leaching process to basically break up the rocks and pull out some of the minerals that, you know, was an old farming technique that they knew. So he trucked in a whole bunch of sulfuric acid one day and started spraying it on his fields to reconstitute the soil. And he realized that this stuff sort of foamed up and fizzled and into this white powdery cake that sort of appeared on top of the land. And he was curious, and he was like, I wonder what this stuff really is. And what he did, he picked up a little piece of it, and he put it on his picnic table. And it was kind of a cloudy day, and he noticed that when the sun came out behind the clouds, this white powder sort of just fizzled and poof and disappeared. And he thought, oh, that's interesting. So he took another piece of it, put it on the picnic table, and he set a pencil on top of it. And he waited for it to fizzle and disappear. He went away for a few hours, came back. Sure enough, it did. And he cut the pencil in half, and he noticed that there were tracer marks, sort of burn marks that had run right through the wood in the pencil. So he thought, well, what's in this stuff that is essentially has so much energy that it can cut right through this wood? And he basically spent millions and millions of dollars in the next 15, 20 years of research into these monoatomic elements, as he called them ORMEs, orbitally rearranged monoatomic elements. And it seems that there's an alternate state of these matter that, you know, is not traditionally known about. It's not part of the periodic table. These elements are on the periodic table, but what we need to do is, as we're understanding these more, is to create sort of a three-dimensional aspect to the periodic table, because these have super-deformed orbitals, and the nuclei has a different shape of these elements, and they can't be detected.
So, but they also have a mystical element. People have according to Hudson back in the 80s, people had some really far-out experiences.
Right. So what happened is he jumped to that. He was essentially refining these things, and he was making these white gold powders, and he was making powders from iridium and rhodium, and he had his uncle or something, I think, came to him, and he said, you know, Dave, this stuff you're working on, I've been reading these books on alchemy, and I think what they're talking about here is the Philosopher's Stone. You've discovered the Philosopher's Stone, and you can consume this, and it has all these health benefits. So what he did is he did a few tests with some friends, and they actually consumed them. The next thing you know, they were saying, you know, Dave, I'm having all these weird apparitions. I'm having conversations with angels. I'm flying out of my body at night. A lot of these spiritual sort of aspects, people were having instantaneous sort of kundalini awakenings.
Will people have that from making the ormus that you're going to be doing with the sea salt?
Well, the sea salt is sort of the get your feet wet kind of version. It's a beginning. It's a good way to get some very small traces without these. Of course, the ones that David was producing were highly concentrated, you know, pure gold white powder, and that has a very powerful effect. But at least when you're using a nice balance from the ocean, you're not going to just pop out of your body right away. It's sort of a nice way to gently ease into the spiritual side of things.
So if you can wrap it all up as far as alchemy and this, and in a way Ormus is a new kind of offshoot of alchemy, and what the overall benefit of being an alchemist is, what would you say?
Right. I guess that, you know, it goes back to understanding nature, and I think that the humanity has gone, you know, into such an evolution of technology. We're accelerating rapidly towards this, you know, almost the point of singularity, as some people would put it, this mysterious attractor, where technology is ramped up so quickly, so fast that, you know, is this part of our evolution? And we have to stand back and remember what we, you know, sort of lost, because we can create a balance between today's, you know, high-tech lifestyle and looking at the way the ancients evolved spiritually. They did it through nature. So I think what alchemy can provide for people is giving them an understanding of how nature has always evolved and how nature is self-sustaining, whereas in our sort of technological world, the way we go today, it doesn't look like we're in much of a self-sustaining state. So in my personal beliefs, we have to go back and look at the way these ancient philosophers viewed nature and how they worked in harmony with nature. And those are some of the benefits of learning these alchemical processes, is it puts you in touch with that.
Because nature itself is sort of an alchemical lab. I mean, how does all these elements exist anyway, right?
Absolutely. You know, there's no greater alchemy than nature itself. Nature is the greatest alchemist. Mm. And everything is self-sustained and perfectly in harmony.
Well, everything you've talked about is really exciting. I mean, it brings back memories for me, or past life or something, where it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. You know,
yeah.
One of my favorite books is called The Red Lion. Have you read that?
Which is right. About, yes. Yes. Yeah. A lot of people have told me about it. I haven't actually read it, but I know the book for sure.
It's a great book, and it's part of the process, The Red Lion. Well, I'm excited that Roger's hosting you in New York this weekend, Feng Shui Seminars, .com. That's the website.
Yeah, that's right.
And your website, personally, is what?
My website, currently I don't really have too much up on the web. I've kind of laid low and worked underground on a lot of these things, but I think a lot of people are having a lot more interest in some of this knowledge. So I'll be looking at putting together something. And I have a number here if you'd like to find out more information for the workshop.
Yes.
Yeah, it's 848-702-3779, and that's Roger Green's contact.
Right. That's great. So
we're going to have a great time this weekend. Yeah.
Maybe I'll meet you this weekend. Where are you based out of?
Myself, or here we're in Manhattan for the workshop, but I'm based out of Calgary in Alberta in Canada.
Oh, you're in Calgary out there. All right.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we could do more interviews because we really didn't touch the great work, which is okay. I mean, you can't do it all in 1 hour. It's centuries.
That's right. It's a lifelong process.
Centuries in development. So it's great to give people a taste of what real alchemy is. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alan.
How do you say your last name again?
Electrum. Aurelius Electrum.
Right. And he'll be in New York this weekend at Roger Dean's place. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and you can reach me at newrealities.com or email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. This is a song called Green Fire, In the Fire. Thanks for listening. Such fire, universe awaits. The ball thread, trail of light, fearless speed and fight. Walking through this fire, and no one ever ends.